The following program is being brought to you on the Green Talk Network. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit thegreentalknetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
This is Bill Reed
and John Becker
with Building Deeper Green. And we have as our guest today Carol Sanford, who we'll be introducing in a few minutes. And in order to lead up to that and to our discussion with Carol, I want to set the stage. One of the issues that is of significant concern, but we probably haven't been doing the sustainability shtick long enough in our culture to really understand the implications of this, is that what do we do when we're done with the project? What do we do when we're done installing the technology? How do we actually make sure that we are, when we build a quote-unquote sustainable building, that in fact we're keeping the building from suffering entropy, from actually going downhill? How do we inspire people to be engaged in the project so that it actually continues to improve? Because obviously when we're doing, for instance, LEED buildings, we actually haven't created a sustainable condition, but we need to create a culture that's going to continue to work towards that, and a culture of people in the building. So what we're talking about ultimately when we're talking about sustainability is how sustainable are we as people, and what do we look forward to, what do we need to do to actually evolve and participate in the living systems that our buildings are part of.
So in other words, the question I think we're asking is, how can we sustain sustainability? So Bill,
yes.
Do you have an answer to that?
well, we probably don't have an answer to that, but we do have an idea of what's necessary. And we talked with Ben Haggard a couple episodes ago about the nature of the food system. And it was interesting, Ben didn't talk as much about food, although he did, as he talked about the will of a community to actually reintegrate themselves and understand the nature of food production and soil health and habitat health, et cetera. So for Ben, it was actually a process of engaging the community in a different way, not just sending out experts to do stuff for them, but to actually help the community understand their role in that system.
Well, and Joel, then, in the last episode, in terms of understanding how do we sustain life in a place and recognizing its patterns, really utilized the same theme in terms of the interaction of the humans of a place, being of the place, and loving the place, and thereby participating in its health.
So in fact, what we were talking about with Joel is developing human understanding. And along with that, then, it's just not an understanding of the place, it's an understanding of ourselves. And what we're working with Carol is it sounds very esoteric, but in fact, unless we understand ourselves, and as we've opined before many times, unless we are developing ourselves, how is it that we can actually begin to positively affect and develop, in the true sense of the word, of creating new potential, develop the environment we live in?
Well, and Bill, this reminds me of something that's come up on a couple of episodes, and that is a sort of simple, what's almost become a mantra for me these days as a function of this program, is that we cannot create new potential in the world unless we create new potential in ourselves. And it appears to me that that's very much the kind of work that Carol has helped all kinds of folks do. So,
yeah, and it's just remarkable how many, when you talk to people in these terms, people roll their eyes back. I mean, they kind of flutter and they glaze over. And say,
yeah, why is that,
that
by
have
way?
To do with practicality? That word practical.
So wait a minute. You're saying that they do that because they don't believe that has to do with practicality.
Yeah, or they don't understand it. They can't understand that it's practical at all.
Well, then let's ask Carol about this, because if that's the case, maybe she can help us understand this better. And by means of introduction, Carol Sanford is the CEO of two different companies, Interactive and Developmental Economies. She refers to herself as a resource to regenerating businesses and communities. So with that, welcome, Carol.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So, Carol, Bill had mentioned that when we talk about creating new potential in ourselves, people's eyes tend to roll back in their heads and say this isn't practical. So with that as sort of an introduction, what is it that you do, and how do you make this practical?
More of a challenge than an introduction.
That's great. Well, one of the things that triggered me thinking is that you would never put people to work on a machine without improving their capability to operate that machine. And, in fact, we've set up colleges and universities and all sorts of programs to build people's capability to do things we can see. What's amazing to me is the mind that is working on all those things is kind of assumed to just be ready to do all of that work. And so we end up putting to people to work with kind of an undeveloped mind on the kinds of things that you guys are talking about in this program. So for me, it's incredibly practical because it leads to whether or not we actually can conceive of and think well enough to work on the things like the completed building, like the business we have to build, like the community we have to build.
Even the design, I can't believe it. It just occurs to me now after how many decades of doing this. John, one of the problems that I know you have, and I certainly have, and even working with design teams, is teaching them for the need to do a good energy model. They don't understand, they don't even have the capability to do that, which is why we have a lot of resistance.
Well, and that in and of itself is external, but if you don't have the mind that says, boy, I really can't make an informed decision without that piece of information.
Well, why do I have to do this?
Well, and that's really where I was getting to. And I think that really formulates a question I'd like to ask Carol is that, okay, why is this important? Why is having the right mind, based on your experience, important beyond the technical?
Well, if you can kind of visualize that the way the actions we have take place are preceded immediately by a thought that an action needs to take place. Now, that all happens so fast that it's not like we make a decision to do that. But there is a thought. And whatever the quality of that thought is going to determine the outcome. And we can see that when we make decisions about investing that don't work very well or the way to handle our kid on a particular evening that didn't go the way we thought we would, that the thought we had was not getting us somewhere. So some people will back up from that and say, I should think about some different things. So they may try and read and educate so that they can have new thoughts. And they may even talk to their friends to get new thoughts with the intention, again, of producing a different outcome. What this is a question even behind that. So here are the kind of improving what I would think about so I could have a better thought, so I could have a better action. It turns out that how you're able to think has more impact than any of those. So if how I can think about something is I can become much more comprehensive, I can begin to see things changing, I can begin to understand the working of things, then I'm going to improve significantly the kind of thoughts that I have that lead to the outcomes I have. So there's a direct correlation between the capacity of the mind to even come up with new ideas based on how well it can work.
So, Carol, what was the path that you took to reach this realization? How did you get here?
How did I get here? Well, I think when I first decided to go to graduate school some years ago that I was aggravated by how many what I called side effects and secondary impacts happened from all the actions that were taken. And in that particular case, it was a lot by government, a lot by cities, and national, global. And I said, you know, people will set out with good intentions, and then so many things go awry.
You mean unintended consequences?
The unintended consequences. So I kind of started when I was in my early 30s or late 20s trying to figure out how in the world did those unintended consequences come about. And my first track into it was through working on a master's degree in urban planning and business sort of simultaneously and ending up teaching in that field because I could see that it was a crossover between disciplines pretty quickly and that part of the problem were these broken up disciplines.
So we weren't seeing systems.
Right. And we even had the cybernetic systems as a part of this program that I was teaching in a master's level program. So if you enter entered cybernetic systems, which we now call information technology, or you entered urban planning, or you entered business, you had to study in all three programs. And I could see immediately the ability to have our students have to walk in through those different doors on different days changed how they walked back into the other room. So that had a huge impact on me, and unfortunately, the deans didn't see that so well, and after 2 years' experiment, they canceled it. And I found myself asking the question, well, where are the people who seem to be having the most impact, and if you were going to work there, I have a very strategic mind, and I'm always wanting to ask, where do you go touch something? You know, sometimes, and probably you've heard Joel and Ben call these like the acupuncture point. And for me, that turned out to be the business world, because it was almost more in charge of governance, from what I could see, than governments were in many cases. So I moved into the world of business, and it's always been a challenge when people ask me which piece of the business I work on. I say, all of it, because you can't work on the all of it. You can't work on any part of changing it and improving if you aren't working on the whole. And, in fact, that's where businesses get in trouble. They work on fragments. And now that's even led me to realize...
It's where the environment gets in trouble, too.
Yeah, Beth, we've talked about that so many times, right?
Yeah.
That we focus on fragments. But now, I don't want to interrupt your story, but I want to hold a question. So
sure.
Please continue.
That has led me, to where I am now, which is I'm involving businesses extensively in trying to understand their role in a community and the place that they are and how their own capacity to realize what they want is really intricately connected to the planet on which they live, the communities in which they live. So that's kind of how I got, but all of it has been an increasing ability to create a systemic understanding. And I can come back and talk about what you have to focus on to do that, but I'm curious about what your question was.
Yeah, my question's kind of that, and it is the paradox that we run into, I think, Bill, quite frequently. I know I do in my work, and I think we've talked about this quite a bit, is in order to influence in a positive way a system, or in any way a system, we need to understand that it is a system and it's a whole. However, it's really hard to hold the whole. Therefore, the tendency mm-hmm. is to focus on fragments. So, we've seen the evidence of that. The question I have is the paradox between holding the whole and also needing to understand the fragments to address the whole.
Well, I'm not even sure there are fragments of the whole, but I understand what you're asking. It's like aspects are different.
Yeah.
You have to focus on something at a point in time and not lose that it's in a bigger context. Does that fit with what you're
Yeah,
asking?
And we've been calling those in the context of living systems the four key subsystems.
Right, and of course, are those ecological subsystems?
The four that we've been using are habitat, which is both human and other biotic systems.
Uh-huh.
Water, energy, and materials.
Right, so they tend to be planetary nature
yes.
of systems,
and then we added a fifth, which is consciousness.
Right. I talk about that if you want to really look at a whole, that there, in the sense you're talking about, there's a planetary and a social aspect, and that's where, you know, human systems come and interface with those living systems. But your question was how you hang on to it. And I think what I'd like to start with is what people have tried to do to make it work that I think is very limited, and then come back and talk about what it is that really I think you have to leap to. I published a paper at Wharton that was talking about the four different levels of trying to think systemically. And the base one, which is the one that most people are really struggling with right now, is they try and build linkages. So they'll try and map kind of the relationship of this fits to this fits to this, and they'll try and write on those, you know, lines that show how this part connects to this part. And there actually is something good happens in that, because the mind will make more links than you can ever make on the paper.
Is that fairly linear?
It's very linear because of the, and it still tends to look at parts related to parts, and it's like almost trying to build it inductively back from the parts we broke apart. Let's see if we can figure out how to put them together. And it really comes out of a cybernetic model of how machines work, because if you look at how a computer program is structured with the binary working of it, then you're building linkages to linkages to linkages. And that's how we used to think the mind worked. And so we're actually working with some pretty outdated sciences right now in trying to understand systems. What I believe people have to shift to is something that is much more focusing and can coalesce all of it, how it fits together into one piece. And I'll name that, and then we'll figure out what the right questions are. But the name for that might be the essence or the identity of each entity and trying to understand what its vocation or contribution is. And we all are curious about who we are uniquely, and so is a business. And that's what I found working with becomes a much more systemic starting point and a foundation out of which you actually can go then look at aspects, but you don't tend to break them apart.
Okay, Carol, on that note, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to actually talk about how this is applicable in the practice world.
Okay.
Green Talk Network is here. Spread the green.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Welcome to the Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everybody, to Building Deeper Green with our guest, Carol Sanford. And, Carol, we left at the beginning of the break with the concept of essence.
Yeah.
Tell us what that is.
Sounds really abstract, doesn't it? You know, it's the most amazing thing, and we all kind of know it intuitively. I read a piece of research a few years back that told me how much people already know this and want to know it, when it said that the one thing you can do to sell a magazine on the newsstands is you can put a test on it that says, find out which type you are in regard to something. And the popularity of typing and typologies that people do in businesses, you know, I'm one of four types or I'm one of eight or nine types, tells us the kind of hunger we have for trying to understand ourselves through trying to have some mirror or some way to look at it.
Oh, yeah, all the different permutations of the Myers-Briggs test, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually am very much a contrarian relative to those, because I think they do a lot of looking and organizing the personality, like how you compare to other people. And you probably are one of four types compared to your personality. But behind that is something that is unique and distinctive. And there are usually two times that we're kind of overtly aware of it, unless you end up working in my world. And one of them is when you're born, and in the first year of your life, people start to speculate on, you know, who this kid is and what he's like. And we talk a lot about it. And then the next time we do it is after you die. And so at that point, you can see something distinctive about people. It happens at the level of individual, where what you're really talking about is that which is who you are at some level that fundamentally underlies everything you do, the decisions you make, the way you behave, the choices you make, the way you react to things, and it is how people can identify you, and each of us have that. What's more amazing, and the more in an increasingly practical side of it, is the same is true for a business. When it's born, when it's brought into existence, and let me just take, for example, quickly if I can, DuPont Corporation, which I've been blessed to work with over a series of years. It was born about 206 years ago, and E.I. DuPont, who came over from France in the middle of the Revolution, was a person who had been working with the making of gunpowder in the French Revolution. He then kept his interest in that, but what he was so good at was being able to manage all the risk relative to it, and he would design intricate systems to make sure it was managed carefully. Well, if you look at what DuPont did over the years, it was really right on target as long as it stayed on top of that essence of managing risks, and it got in trouble when it started buying and consolidating businesses which were unrelated to what it was uniquely about. And then Chad Holliday and even somewhat Ed Woolard for years brought it back to this idea of managing risk and started to develop new businesses, like how do you manage fisheries in a way that you don't actually degrade the natural fish streams.
So they identified their core, not what they did.
Exactly. And they sold off things that were not a part of their core. And so core is another way. And I think the whole idea that is core competencies is trying to go at that. But it again, it's kind of like the personality test. It looks more at what you can do, not who you are. And what I've found is that when a company can do that, they get clearer first about who they are, and then you can start to do a strategic direction, which is much more powerful.
So, Carol, ultimately, I think we want to bridge this back to what Joel was talking about, because Joel was talking about the same thing, the essence or nature of a place as well.
Right.
Well, and that then leads me to a question that, again, seems paradoxical. And that is, okay, if each of us as individuals has an individual essence, yet we are inseparable from the whole. Mm-hmm. Hence, if that's the case, we can't see that essence in isolation. How is it then that one understands that essence in ways that sees the connection to the whole? I'm not articulating that well.
It's a tough question. I think it's at some level what spiritual searches are about, you know, how do I fit with something? I have a very practical, concrete way of working on it. Every individual, let's just take you, John, and you, Bill, have something distinctive that draws you, and that if we spend time talking about it, you can kind of get down to what really enlivens you when you're most alive, most trying to create something.
I mean, the thing that jazzes me.
Yeah, thing that jazzes
things.
You. And there is now out of that something that might be called, what do you want to contribute to that greater whole of which you're part? That's where the link gets built. So there's who you are, but it gets built by, I call it everything from your core task to your vocation to your direction about what it is that you want to be doing. Some people, you also know the number of programs that are sold to help you find your purpose in life. And I think that comes increasingly about when people don't know who they are and they don't know exactly how they could contribute. And part of that is they don't know how they fit with the way the world is moving or the industry which they're in.
Or the places they live.
Okay, let's take an example of that one. One of the really fun things about looking at cities or communities, the way that Joel and Ben are talking about, where you have this sense of place, is you actually can understand that the place has a vocation, and it comes about from something that's unique. Like, let's take Portland, Oregon. So Portland is very much in its essence, and I mean, even if you look at Lewis and Clark on their way headed there and what they said when they got there, what they found was a place that loved its relationship to nature. And everyone who, I mean, Lewis and Clark wanted to stay there forever because they just loved, but they had to go back. When people come and visit Portland, what the city has found is if they're people who love nature, they want to live there. it is actually ended up then therefore focusing on developing businesses and industries which are very much about connecting with nature, about being active in nature, not just passive, but therefore you get Nike and Adidas with their headquarters there. You get major food growing operations that are unique and distinctive to the kind of food that people relate to coming from nature and are fresh. They have huge winemaking businesses, and they have no trouble attracting people to come work there and live there because it is the essence of that place calling the essence of the business, which is calling the essence of the individuals who work there.
So if you wanted to, let's say, work with a community that wasn't Portland, that didn't have that extent in their current condition,
yeah,
yet the purpose was to improve the health of the place in a way that the people are contributing to that, what might be, let's say, the beginning of a process of how you would start to work with that community to accomplish that end?
Well, I think you've heard some of this, but let me reiterate it and then connect it to what I just said. You have to start with re-enlivening people's sense of what that place is. And let me talk a little bit about having done that in South Africa. I had the glorious opportunity to be working in South Africa with Colgate-Palmolive the 2 years before the election and the year afterwards. So you're in the midst of a country called rebirthing itself. And what had gotten lost over the years was the sense of what was really unique and distinctive about this country. And what you did is we started with versions of really trying to understand its identity as a country. And I think every region and every place needs to do that as a foundational beginning. But then the really important part begins to translate it into what does that mean for how you govern? What does it mean for how you run businesses? So in this case, we were working with the councils that Mandela was setting up, and we wanted them to all have a kind of what they called a spirit resonance. And the language that they came up with was renew freedom. And you could see that ringing through Mandela's words. You could see ringing through the people who lived in the townships who also worked in the company. And that ability to start there, to reawaken that, is really important. We carried that back into the company. So we said, well, what does it mean to renew freedom? And that the country had always been about that. I mean, you could, as far back as we could go. Well, we said it meant that you had to change the way you marketed. We no longer had sales. We no longer had people just selling through the traditional channels. We asked people who lived in the townships what the people there were trying to create and how we could support and enliven that. One of the guys, Isaac Mashiel, amazing, amazing black man who lived in Alexandria Township, came up with an idea, which was he wanted to improve the dental health, and of course Colgate sold toothpaste, of all the children in his village. And he created a way to make available in very small quantities and teach children how to brush their teeth. It increased the sales for the company, but we tracked it with a dentist who was doing research through one of the universities there and found that we improved the health of the children. That came straight out of the work that started on how do you know a place, which was renew freedom, and then the freedom came from an individual in a company who took that, and he figured out what his contribution could be.
Okay, well, let's take that now and say, how would you approach, in the same way that the first thing you did was identify what's unique about this place, and then what does that mean for how you might govern this place or how you might develop a business here, how would you then translate that into what does it mean to develop communities here?
Okay. When Mandela said that what he wanted were township councils, which would become part of leading the new change, the thing that he didn't do, because he was a part of this discovery of the Renew Freedom, was he said, I think each one needs to be related to the township. So Soweto Township is a very different place, had different tribal mixes and so forth, and that it needed to have principles, that you couldn't have freedom unless you had principles, because otherwise what you had was chaos or anarchy. So for them, the next step was to translate into what were the principles out of which each governing council operated, but had freedom to create what it needed to renew its own township. So that was like a next step of how do you make this really amazing essence idea, very concrete in how it is that you achieve something. And so, in that case, it was principles.
In other words, what are the principles to exemplify that essence of freedom?
Right. Right.
So if you were now to...
Now, let me just skip for a second to a company, because in a company, you create managing principles. So let me pick that up and translate it over to a business, the idea of how you make this second phase, this idea of principles. In the case of a company like Seventh Generation, we went back and we looked at what's the essence of the company. And that's a little longer process to describe, but let's just say that one of the core elements of Seventh Generation, who makes non-toxic products, is authenticity, and that comes out of their founder. We said, what would the managing principles be you'd have to operate as a company to live up to that essence of authenticity? And one that they wrote was to act from wholeness, which meant you told the entire perspective on a story, not just the part you believed in stood for, but you said, now there are other people who are holding this, plus you, to the press, told people everything that you knew that was going on, including when they found that one of their products had had a contamination to it, and everyone said, yeah, but it meets federal, you know, FDA regulation, it's not a problem. They said, but our way of operating is to tell the whole story. So if you think about that as the next step of once you know who you are in a business, you would have all of your people being able to connect to that kind of principle.
So it's operating from a condition of integrity, of fully understanding and representing what you are.
Well, that's who they. That's their essence. So again, I'm trying to tie it back, and of course we'd want everybody operating with something like that. But the idea is the essence of Seventh Generation is authenticity. So, but that's just an abstract idea unless you create managing principles, and then you use them to audit and reflect and upgrade your behavior, change all of your practices embedded in your business.
And the same thing goes with, and we didn't really touch on this with Joel, in terms of living systems. You understand the essence of a place, you understand then the principles of life that are drawn out of that, and then you can begin to apply measurable issues to them that you can actually act on and refine.
Right.
Well, that again leads me to the question, okay, if now you've identified what's unique about the place, what's unique about the people in the place, thereby defining what principles there are upon which you'll be making decisions, what would be the next step if the task was to create and develop a physical community in a place?
Well, one of the things that you have to do at this stage, once you've recalled and recreated all the energy of people around this story of places, you have to break some patterns that have had you on a path going in the kind of an off-course direction.
Although I do think we have to hold right there for
okay.
a moment, Carol. If you can
we'll
hold
come back
that thought,
to that.
We'll take a break and we'll be right back.
All right.
Welcome to the Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
Careful at the party, hon. No alcohol, right?
I know, Mom.
Seriously, you're still growing, and it messes with your judgment.
Yeah, I know.
Trust me, you could do some things you don't really want to do. If you're a grown woman, it's different, but you're not.
I know, okay? I know.
Teenagers know everything. So talk about underage drinking before they know it all. Before they're teens. Start talking before they start drinking. And keep talking. Learn more at StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What can you tell me about SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA teaches you employability skills. So you know how to deal with people, you have teamwork, your resume is going to look awesome.
Well, it's important to know your technical skills, but not only that, to have soft skills, the skills of learning how to communicate with people.
The web at skillsusa.org.
Welcome to the Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking today with our guest, Carol Sanford. And where we left was, Carol was beginning to help us understand how practically, we can do this work in terms of connecting the essence of a place to the essence of a person or the people of that place. So, Carol?
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to do because it makes people's lives meaningful. So I love this question. I'm going to take an example of where this actually happened, and then we'll create the concept out of it about how you do it. I do this with a company in every case so that you're actually connecting each individual's essence to what it is the business is seeking to do. And in one case where we were doing that, let's take Kingsford Charcoal in Kentucky. There was one man in the company among many who people call illiterate. It's a very demeaning word because they're incredibly smart people. They just didn't happen to learn to read and write. But he felt that there was a need to have the equipment that they were running, people actually understand more about it if they were going to take on improving it. And he wanted to be able to write manuals. Now imagine, someone who cannot read and write decided that that's something that really needed to happen. So one of the keys here is that it initiates from an individual's will to really create something that they can see is needed in a larger system. And without that link between the individual and the larger system, it's very hard to awaken this kind of essence being realized. What he did is started working with a variety of people who said, okay, I can't read and write either, and I've never told you this, but I'd like to actually help you create the manuals. And by the way, I'd like to create a newsletter because I think there are things that people need to know about what's going on that we should learn to write up in a newsletter. In that process, teachers began to be hired. It actually extended out beyond the factory into involving people in the community and even including the children who were in the families of the mostly men who could not read and write. This enlivening process of individuals speaking to something they wanted to contribute, this activation of personal will, is the kind of thing that's really important to be able to connect to the changing of a place. What we tend to do is we pull together collaboratives and they say what needs to be done and they make assignments. And so it comes from some larger, quote, vision, which a community finally agreed on and is then made available to people to contribute to. I suggest that's upside down, that it really has to start with asking individuals in the company what do they want to contribute, and the essence, by the way, answers that question, what I want to contribute. And it's to not just anything you want, but the strategy of what the business is about or the strategy of what a community is seeking to create. So you can see it makes sense in the lineage we've talked about here. If you connect to place first, you develop principles. Now individuals can initiate from their own will something they want to make happen. And it also awakens the need to grow themselves, gain mastery. So now we're into the personal development element. And I don't believe you can awaken it any other way but kind of through this channel that we just went through. Is that making sense, John?
It really does. There's an outcome, I think, to that Kingsford story that I'd love to hear.
Ah, well, there are several pieces of the outcome. First, it fundamentally changed the local community because it turns out that large percentages of the people who lived in Burns, Kentucky, where this plant was, couldn't read and write, and the program was eventually expanded to the entire community. It allowed a certain number of businesses to start being born because the nature of this also has an incubating effect in that it can support and grow a system. Then eventually it became so well known that people started trying it statewide, and Kingsford actually agreed to even resource people, not to copy theirs, but to create the process again. And eventually the governor issued them what's called the Toyota Award, because Toyota is there and they provide a kind of award every year to people who make a contribution to the lives of their communities while doing business. The other thing was that this process had a business impact, which was significant because this nature of process, although what they worked on was different in each of the different locations, flipped upside down how Kingsford had been contributing to Clorox as a company. And it went from something like that one-third of the people were producing one-sixth of the profits to one-sixth of the people were producing one-third of the profits for the company.
Mm.
And so this has a very practical business effect, but it also, they closed several plants in this process. And they did it with all of the people involved in designing, and with one of their managing principles was, no one is out of a job until they have the same or better level to contribute in the community. they got letters to the board of directors of Clorox of people thanking them for how they closed their plant and eliminated their job. You don't see that very often.
Wow. Yeah. Bill, this is that story that Carol just told, it sounds very much like a metaphor, a metaphorical way of thinking about, in the same way that Kingsford improved the social equity condition of the people in that place, for working on a development whereby we can improve the physical health of a place.
Right, and this gets, and again, as I think this is probably so often happening on the show, people are saying, I'm just an architect. I just want to build a building. And yet we are talking about sustainability. We are talking about healing this planet. It's kind of remarkable, and I don't know if we have time to get, well, we kind of got been there, but how did we get in this position in the first place that we actually have to go through this healing process, not only the healing of the damage we've caused in our ecosystems, but the damage we've caused to human beings?
Well, if you don't mind, I'd rather not spend any time on that anymore.
No, I don't want, but yeah. I want to interject. That is the point. And then, so what does that mean in terms of the practice of design is what we're getting?
Well, I think this brings us right back to the question that started the program. How can we sustain sustainability? Because
right.
I think the question is, Carol, how then does this process impact the continuing evolution of a people in a place that is healthy and sustainable?
Well, I was actually thinking about it even standing in the architect's shoes.
Oh, that'd be great.
What I'm thinking is, if people came to understand this, and I've been blessed to work with you guys as architects and a few others in my life because they're often building buildings. Architects who actually come to understand that they are stewards of something bigger, and not all of them get there, but increasing numbers, will not allow something to be built without the right process being in place, because they know that the answer to Bill's question about how we got in trouble was that we started in a place that could not get us to where we wanted to go. We started in a place that people would let us do, and we allowed it to happen because our profession or our career or our job was kind of on the line. But what if architects stood for the idea that you don't start without the story of place being in place, and reconnecting and awakening people, because then the project you're designing, the building, the city, I mean, however big it is tied to something you know is going to enliven people, and first it's going to be a lot more fun for the architect to do.
So here's an image. More often than not, architects find themselves fighting zoning hearing boards where there are crowds of people saying, we don't want this project.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Let's imagine crowds of people in that room saying, we want this project.
Right. And you can't, I mean, like, doing the project is too far down the line. You asked me specifically, where do you start?
Yeah.
You start with getting the community excited about who it is, and then creating the kind of managing processes and strategies about how to be more of that. Now you've got an architect who walks in, or a construction company, or, you know, any number of entities. And when they walk in to and through and with that story and with those principles and with that strategy. So it would create, I think, a very exciting way to be in the architectural field, which I, rather than just trying to convince people that you've got the right drawings, which are going to meet the codes. And I've even seen city officials get very excited about this.
Yeah, we are too. And this is a beautiful way of seeing the whole by marrying this, integrating this with exactly the kinds of things Joel was talking about in the last episode. And then when we bring it into our food supply systems, it's exactly the same thing Ben was talking about just prior to that.
Well, the key is you have to start with the story of place. You have to start with this larger whole. What too often happens in the design process is people design a building and then they expect to sell it in a way that is not whole. They're selling the object rather than they're selling the process of discovery.
So that process of discovery, Bill, it sounds like is very much initiated by asking the simple question that Carol asked, what is unique about this place?
Right. What's so great about that is just like people love to discover who they are, people love to talk about themselves, right? I mean, Carol, in your experience, people love to discover their essence.
They do.
Right?
Yeah.
And we heard from Joel how people love to discover the place and the essence of that place. And this is really a marrying of the essence of people and the essence of place.
I think so.
Sounds to me like that's what you were saying with the companies, the essence of the people and the essence of the companies being
aligned.
Well,
let me go back and add just a little bit, an additional answer to the question John asked earlier about how I got to this. In some ways, what I have think I have grown over time, and I actually did doctoral work on a psychology, which was like, how do you help individuals grow? But I started to see that how intricately linked the essence of an individual is to their ability to contribute to the essence of a place or a company within a place, and now for cities, communities, regions to be able to figure out how they fit within a larger either bioregion or sometimes nation like we did in South Africa. So they aren't separate things. They're all the same thing that are held together by this thread that is the essence or the identity of an entity and its vocation and work for the next set of systems it's a part of.
So then I'm hearing you suggest that a critical and essential piece of this work is helping folks also understand that they are part of a nested whole with everybody else and every other organism in that place.
Yeah, and over time, their ability to hang on to increasingly larger nested wholes of which they're a part is a capacity we have to start building in our schools and our parenting processes, because we tend to not see us as a part of a larger context, much less a set of nested versions of that, as you just said.
Now that's another vision. Imagine designing a school whose purpose was, in fact, that.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about that.
What would that building look like, right?
We're headed into a break. So let's talk about that in terms of how do we actually do this work.
We'll be back in a couple minutes, folks. Thanks.
The Green Talk Network is here. Spread the green.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Now we'll hear Mozart's violin concerto.
Ben's rendition is awful because he's playing a violin with a banana. But bananas could help you become a better violin player. Eating fruits with potassium and other nutrients help your muscles work better. So bananas can be instrumental after all. Run, throw, think, eat better. Can your food do that? Find out at smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome to the Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're speaking with our guest today, Carol Sanford. And Carol has been walking us through a process of how one connects the essence of a place with the essence of the people, and in very, very practical ways from much of her experience in doing precisely this with businesses. And I think that leads to a question of, Carol, what do you have to know to do this work?
Well, you can ask it at the level of knowledge, which you just did. I'm going to answer it at the level of capability, which includes knowledge. I think in some ways it took me a long time and an iteration to be able to effectively do what we're talking about. And I would say the biggest thing that shifted for me and what I do with the wonderful young folks who work with me now learning to do this is we work on seeing the world in a different way. And the first thing is you actually just have to notice that you've got a particular way of seeing. And that way of seeing is we tend to see parts and pieces. We see fragments. So you have to actually practice learning how to see systems. There's an interesting piece of research that I can't remember right this second where it comes out of, but I'll find it if anyone, you know, follows up with you and wants to know, which looked at the Chinese compared to American students in a university and found that when they had Americans or Westerners look at a picture and then ask them about it, that they would describe what was in the foreground of that picture. In other words, they would zero in on a piece of something, and whereas if you asked the Chinese to look at it, they tended to look at the broader background because of the way they were brought up, the way their language works is they see context. And then if you ask the Americans or the Westerners what changed in the picture, if they changed something, if you changed it in the background, they couldn't see it. You had to change it in the foreground, and, of course, vice versa for the Chinese. Now, what if we could do both of those? Because right now what we have is the ability to usually see, if you're a Westerner, the pieces and that which is most right in your face. And in the Asian world, you can see the context, but you can't always see what the strategic focus is. I think that's a piece of the capability is this literal shifting of our ability to see moving, dynamic, living things. I think people who do photography learn this in some way. So there's a practice of actually developing a mental capability. But the second half has to do with managing the part of me that is my ego, my personality, that can be disrupting because I want to look smart, I want to already have the answers, and therefore I try and do what's simple, or I try and give you something fast. So there's a personal development piece, most of which has to do with working on what's inside of us, how we think and how we manage who we are. I make sure that's a part of every endeavor I work in. In companies, every meeting has a personal development component built into it. In fact, it usually starts every meeting, so people improve their capacity to see and manage themselves. We got to do more of that in communities. We've got to do more of it in universities. It's got to be more part of an education system.
People are probably thinking, as you're talking, Carol, about organizational development and say, well, we already do that. Can you make a distinction?
Yeah. This is not organizational development. This is, I mean, not that it doesn't help an organization, but in every case, I'm tying it to business development. I don't think our organization is almost always done as though it were independent of where the business is going. So it's the same mind, the mind that works on a piece. Well, they run out and they find the best practice programs and they teach everybody. That does not do what we're talking about here. It's the ability to link the strategic direction of the essence of this business to the essence of a person. So much of what I work on with businesses in personal development is really targeted toward what I call promises beyond ableness that people in the company make to do something they don't know how to do, but they know it needs doing, and it'll make a difference to the people that they serve with their products and services, and even internally or in their communities. Once they make that, you've got a very different kind of process at work than a blanketing or sheep dipping of everybody through a particular training or organizational development approach.
In the same way, in working with design firms or organizations that bring in strategic planning and organizational development, working on the business as if it's a separate entity from the place that they're living.
Exactly. You know, Carol, there's something else that I've noticed in hearing you speak, that you use language very precisely. And in fact, using the word ableness instead of ability.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems as if, looking at the practicalities of this, that another capability that one would likely need is an ability or an ableness to use language precisely. Can you talk about that
well,
a little?
Well, it's actually shifting so that the language you use is much more systems-based. Our language actually holds our mind in a particular way. And so when I talk about a limb and a leaf, I am acting as though those are separate things. But if I start to conceptualize a living tree-ing process, which is a very weird word, I'm actually forcing my mind to do something else. So I do talk about that part of what we have to do is read language, but it has an intention of actually reframing how we see the world so that we can see the systems rather than seeing the parts. The word ability, just to take the one you just did, tends to focus on doing. ableness embeds in it not only that I'm able to do it, but I can do it on demand even when it's scary and upsetting, and I'll make myself do it even when I don't want to. So it builds in a being practice, it builds in a will and motivation piece into that word, which is a more of a system than the word ability. Does that make sense?
It really does, because I think that this, what keeps coming up for me is that this, everything that I've heard you talk about seems to be pointing towards practicing on how we can become more conscious, hence intentional.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's a pretty good summary. I mean, consciousness for me is a very practical thing. Some people think of it as, you know, going and sitting in meditation. And I wouldn't deny that that is consciousness, nor that I've practiced it. But what consciousness is for me is right now, in the moment, in this business, in this community, being able to see me in a context, see how I am working internally and externally, see what effects need to produce, and be managing of myself in regard to ensuring I can support and contribute to that happening. Now, that's a lot to watch.
Oh,
but
man.
It is what consciousness is about, is the ability to see, understand the whole, and be able to manage me in that context.
Well, and that's what's required for a sustainable condition.
It is.
If we aren't doing that, we are just rearranging the deck chairs.
Yep. And I teach courses in corporate responsibility at Antioch in Seattle, and I tell them that corporate responsibility isn't about a set of actions only. I mean, there are actions. But a lot of what it's about is, can I be responsible for having the actual capabilities it takes to do things as the world changes? Because the list of things we've got for sustainability right now, first, I think about half of them don't sustain anything. But the other thing is they're going to change, and we have to have the capacity to be resilient. So real corporate responsibility comes out of capacity building to be able to see and change these things as the world changes.
Which speaks to our whole education system and
yep.
the opportunity for design. And on that note,
yes,
I think we're going to have to close down here. Carol, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was so much fun. I enjoyed it.
Oh, Carol, thank you. You know, Bill, the way Carol ended there brought a whole other component to this with regard to resiliency. When we go back to our question of how do we sustain sustainability.
Yeah, sounds like a rich point. So
yeah, I know. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to have much time to talk about it, but it's not only the capability of understanding the essence of oneself in a place. Part of that essence is resilience, so that what we don't end up doing is creating a system that doesn't have multiple diversities in it. I mean, we hear people talk about in the green building world all the time, diversity. Well, that's the purpose of diversity, right?
Well, there's not only diversity, because diversity, I like how Joel says, diversity, you get diversity in a zoo, but you don't have relationships.
That's exactly what I'm getting at.
And so how do we continually build and develop our relationships? And Jerry Wilhelm said, talked about our brothers and sisters.
In fact, learn from the brothers and sisters, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So this is the process of becoming whole, understanding that all entities, all people, all beings, all trees, plants, rocks, soil are in relationship.
So in other words, if we are going to change the world, we need to change ourselves first, because we're an integrally nested component of that whole.
So let's leave on the triptych, John.
So in other words, to do different things, we need to do things differently.
We do things differently. We have to think about them differently.
And to think about them differently, we need to be different. See you next week.
Bye all.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.
The Green Talk Network is here. Spread the green.